Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Monday the 20th of July. Today, the row over resources for UK troops in Afghanistan intensifies, with Labour and the Tories trading blows over plans to ring-fence defence spending.
The pressure for government to commit greater resources to the battle in Helmand is pretty overwhelming.
Also today, the Iranian army has arrested dozens of officers who'd sided with opposition protesters.
There is unhappiness within the ranks of the Iranian security forces, and that's something that the authorities are very, very nervous of.
And 40 years after the moon landings, we ask NASA about the future of space travel.
We're going back to the moon, not for flags and footsteps, but we're going back to the moon for a long-term, sustained presence.
But first, here's Bill Overton with the news and today's papers.
The government has changed its advice on swine flu in an attempt to diffuse a row over its conflicting messages to pregnant women. A new document on the Department of Health's website stresses it's no longer advising women to delay conception until the flu pandemic has passed. But there's still confusion over government advice. It says pregnant women shouldn't alter their behaviour, but should avoid crowds and unnecessary travel. The Health Secretary Andy Burnham will update MPs on swine flu today in a statement to the Commons. A report commissioned by the Prime Minister claims British universities must do more to combat elitism, The Guardian has learned. The document, titled Unleashing Aspiration, is due for release tomorrow and will recommend scrapping tuition fees for students who stay at home. The Prime Minister was so angry he could hardly speak when he learned of the plot to smear Tory MPs, according to the man at the centre of the scandal. Damien McBride has told the BBC he was ashamed of the emails that made obscene and unfounded claims about senior Conservative figures. McBride resigned in April after details of the smear emails were published. George Galloway has given his support to a new government vetting system for those working with young people today. He says he himself was a victim of child abuse. A scheme to vet everyone who wants to work or volunteer with children will start in October. Galloway thinks it'll be worth it if it spares just one child the horror of sexual abuse. In sport, England's cricketers face a nail-biting end to the second Ashes test at Lord's. Australia resume on 313 for 5, requiring a further 252 runs in order to pull off a record-breaking victory. England will look to their talismanic bowler Andrew Flintoff as they attempt to take the final five Australian wickets. Follow over by over coverage at guardian.co.uk/cricket. Now for a look at today's papers, starting with The Times, which leads with news holidaymakers suspected of having swine flu will be turned away by airlines. The Mail calls the confusion over the government's swine flu advice a farce and reports comments from the Home Secretary that the outbreak poses a bigger threat than terrorism. A Saudi Arabian princess has been granted asylum in the UK, according to The Independent. It reports she faced the death penalty for having an illegitimate child with a British man. Michael Jackson's brother Jermaine is pictured on the front of The Sun. He gives the paper an interview about the death of his brother in which he claims someone is responsible. Don't let it be a mystery forever. Meanwhile, the Mirror leads with comments from another brother. Tito Jackson accuses Dr. Conrad Murray of dithering after Michael collapsed. The Express claims visiting your GP could cost £20 in future. The paper cites a think tank report recommending changes for all but the poorest in society. However, the government has said it's against such proposals. The Financial Times focuses on the Tory plans to give new powers to the Bank of England if they're elected. George Osborne, the Shadow Chancellor, also plans to scrap the Financial Services Authority. Meanwhile, The Telegraph reports almost a million people have been forced to work part-time because of the recession. The back pages, and many of the front ones too, are dominated by a grimacing Tom Watson. The 59-year-old missed a putt to win the Open Championship at Turnberry yesterday. Instead, it was the American Stuart Sink who lifted golf's prestigious claret jug after a playoff. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Recent deaths of British soldiers in Afghanistan have put intense pressure on the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. He's been accused of failing to provide enough resources for UK troops. The Tory leader, David Cameron, even questioned the government's commitment to protecting British soldiers. But Lord Mandelson hit back yesterday, contrasting Labour's defence spending promises with those of the Conservatives. Our senior political correspondent, Andrew Sparrow, is in our Westminster office. He says the row over resources shows no sign of letting up.
Yesterday, Peter Mandelson was out, and it seems that in addition to all his other jobs in government, he's now acting as Chancellor and Defence Secretary, because he was telling us that defence spending is going to be protected in the future. We've heard lots about future spending cuts, but he made this slightly mischievous point. He was doing an interview on Sky about an hour after David Cameron, who said that if the Tories got in, although they'd prioritise front-line resources, he made it pretty clear that the defence budget as a whole would be cut. An hour later, up popped Mandelson to say, well, sort of under Labour, defence would be protected.
And the former Defence Secretary John Hutton's also entered the fray. He called for a promised review of the troop numbers to be brought forward from October. Is that likely?
Well, I think it is now, in that the pressure for government to commit greater resources to the battle in Helmand is pretty overwhelming, because last week, you'll remember, we had Sir Jock Stirrup, the chief of the defence staff, the guy in charge of the whole armed services, saying he was busting a gut to get helicopters out to Afghanistan. He has a reputation as being a sort of smooth, dapper establishment, kind of Mandarin sort of general, who doesn't normally ruffle feathers, and this was seen as him putting down a marker that if he didn't get what he wanted, he was going to cause trouble. Also, that came on the back of General Dannett, who's received a lot of flack sort of behind the scenes from ministers in the MOD. He's also been touring Afghanistan last week and demanding extra money. Basically, between them, they've backed the Prime Minister into a corner where if he doesn't come up with the goods, he's going to find the flak just gets too hot for him. If I'm not mixing my Afghanistan metaphors.
Mandelson also said that the government hadn't even received a request for more troops, let alone rejected one.
Well, there's been this ongoing argument about ever since one paper last week reported that Brown had turned down a request for 2,000 extra troops. And he's been asked about this several times and hasn't given a particularly clear answer as to what went on. It seems there's obviously been a bit of a row about what happened, and the military weren't entirely happy with what they got. But whether he turned it down in precisely the way it was reported last week seems unlikely, in the way that they're denying it.
And the Observer also made uncomfortable reading for ministers. It reported that the MOD had the opportunity of buying Sikorsky helicopters made in America for the armed forces. Two such opportunities in the last 3 years, but instead pressed ahead with plans involving British firms.
These are plans that involve refurbishment, I think, of helicopters. And like all, pretty much every MOD procurement project that I've ever read about or written about, they don't seem to be coming on stream on time. I mean, it's obviously 3 years ago, there weren't many people predicting that fighting in Afghanistan was going to get quite as nasty as it is now. So in a sense, you can't win, but it probably didn't make comfortable reading for them at the MOD.
And David Cameron questioning the government's commitment to protecting British troops. I mean, that's quite strong stuff, isn't it?
It is. Both sides are playing politics with this. There's a kind of long-standing convention that while forces are on the ground at war, the political parties back in Westminster should put their differences aside and back our boys. In practice, it never works like that, because matters of war and peace are inherently political, and I think it would be wrong to pretend that you can take the politics out of these events. But what both parties are trying to do is find a way of maximising political advantage without seeming unpatriotic. For Cameron to do that, he's been saying, well, he supports the mission, but he has questions about how Gordon Brown is handling it. Labour, on the other hand, have been throwing it back. They've been saying, well, actually, if the Tories really did support our troops, they would keep quiet. They wouldn't try to gain political advantage. I mean, it's sort of both sides are at it, and it's what politicians do, and it's in the nature of the business. It's slightly disingenuous, because they're not being entirely open about their motives, but that's why he's advancing this new line that it wasn't just about money, it was about commitment, and that somehow if Gordon Brown had been more committed to the army, he could have found the money. You can choose whether or not you want to believe it.
Andrew Sparrow, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/Afghanistan. Also on The Guardian's website, John Hooper on a publishing phenomenon, if ever there was one, the Vatican newspaper, guardian.co.uk/religion. Steve Rose meets the distinctive British architect, Catherine Findlay, guardian.co.uk/architecture. And you can see Alok Jar taking Lindy Hop classes, guardian.co.uk/video. I'm John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, how profits from a bingo hall in one of California's poorest towns are funding controversial Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank.
The vast majority of the people playing bingo in this Hawaiian Gardens town, a small town on the edge of Los Angeles, are Latino. They tend to be poor. Some of them are illegal immigrants.
But first, 36 officers in the Iranian army have been arrested, according to reports from Iran. They'd apparently planned to attend last week's Friday prayers addressed by the former president, Hashemi Rafsanjani, to show solidarity with the demonstrations against last month's disputed presidential election result. Robert Tate is writing about Iran for The Guardian from Istanbul because of reporting restrictions imposed by the Iranian regime.
According to reports that are coming from inside Iran, they have been arrested by army intelligence agents after it came to light that they had intended to go to Hashemi Rafsanjani's Friday prayer session last week at Tehran University wearing their military uniforms, and they were going to do this to express solidarity with the demonstrations against the election result last month.
How serious is this rebellion?
We don't know. This could be just a very small, isolated, localised thing, or it could be, on the other hand, a sort of nascent sign of something much bigger. I mean, you have to take it with a pinch of salt and say that, really, the 36 army officers, and they're not all that senior. I mean, the most senior of them is at major level, and one of those is retired, I have to add. So really, you have to see it in perspective. What it does show is that there is unhappiness within the ranks of the Iranian security forces, and that is something that the authorities are very, very nervous of.
Now, we saw these protests on Friday after Friday prayers in Tehran, after Rafsanjani broke his silence. What's the next big test of the regime's authority?
We already have a situation where President Ahmadinejad is coming under fire even before he starts his second term. He has appointed as his first presidential deputy a man called Esfandiar Rahim Mashai, who, apart from being one of his best friends, is also the father-in-law to his son. And Mashai, a controversial figure in Iran, he was criticized heavily last summer after he declared that the Islamic Republic of Iran was a friend to all nations of the world, including Israel. So now that President Ahmadinejad, fresh from his heavily questioned renewed mandate, has gone and reappointed this man to an elevated position, he now finds himself under fire, not from supporters of Mr. Mousavi or former President Rafsanjani, but from his own side. Even the hardline Kayhan newspaper is now criticising the appointment, as are hardline members of parliament. And it is reported that even the Supreme Leader is unhappy with this. So I think that what we're now seeing is that even the conservatives themselves, the very hardliners who are ostensibly loyal to President Ahmadinejad, find that loyalty is being tested already, even before he's been re-inaugurated.
Robert Tate. A quick reminder now to follow Guardian Daily. Find out what stories we're covering in the programme before anyone else at twitter.com/Guardian Daily. Millionaire Irving Moskowitz raises funds for contentious Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem and the West Bank through a charity bingo hall in one of the poorest towns in California. The top prize is $500 for the mostly Latino punters at the bingo hall in Hawaiian Gardens on the edge of Los Angeles. But tens of millions of dollars in the bingo hall's profits have been spent funding Jewish settlements on Palestinian land in some of the most sensitive areas of the disputed territory. With the details in Washington is The Guardian's Chris McGreal.
A large proportion of it ends up funding Jewish settlements in the West Bank, particularly one in the centre of Hebron that's extremely controversial because large numbers of Palestinians have been forced out, thousands upon thousands of them, to make way for a few dozen Jewish settlers. But also in East Jerusalem, where various properties have been bought up inside the Muslim quarter of the old city, and in other strategic parts of East Jerusalem that critics of this say fit a pattern, an ideologically driven pattern, to try and cut off Arab populations and to surround East Jerusalem with Jewish communities in order to ensure that it remains part of Israel.
Are the bingo hall's customers aware that the money they spend is being used in this way?
I would have thought for most of them it's highly unlikely. Bingo can only be run in California as a charity operation, and the Bingo Hall builds itself as benefiting the local community, giving money for scholarships and to things such as the local food bank. But in fact, the bulk of it goes to Israeli-oriented interests. And the vast majority of the people playing bingo in this Hawaiian Gardens town, a small town on the edge of Los Angeles, are Latino. They tend to be poor. Some of them are illegal immigrants. Some of them working at the bingo hall technically as volunteers, where they only receive tips, are illegal immigrants. So it's highly unlikely that they have any real comprehension of where this money is going.
And President Obama says Israel's settlements are a major obstacle to peace in the Middle East. Is there much opposition to this within the local community in California?
Well, I think that there's certainly those who've spoken up for it, including some local rabbis, as well as others across the country, who have seen this particular operation as a particularly, as they would put it, sinister part of the whole settlement process. It's run by a man called Irving Moskowitz, who's now a very elderly and retired doctor who made a fortune from buying and selling hospitals. He lost many of his family in the Holocaust, and is very committed to Israel, but has taken a particularly right-wing stance, has opposed the Oslo Peace Accords, and opposes any significant territorial concessions to the Palestinians, including hanging on to all of Jerusalem. That, of course, has caught the attention of those in America who feel very strongly about these issues, as I say, including a group of local rabbis. But I wouldn't say that it's more widely known. It's certainly one of those things that Moskowitz remains pretty much below the radar on this issue.
Chris McGreal. Years ago today, man walked on the moon for the very first time. The moon landings remain a high point of human endeavour, but the Apollo 11 anniversary has focused attention on the future of space travel. This autumn, NASA will undertake the first flight test of its Constellation programme. That's what's taking the place of the agency's ageing space shuttle fleet. One of the goals is to go back to the moon by 2020. Dr. John Olson of NASA told The Guardian why returning to the moon is a priority.
We're going back to the moon, not for flags and footsteps, but we're going back to the moon for a long-term sustained presence. And we're going to use the moon as a stepping stone to Mars. We're going to look at other interesting spots like asteroids or near-Earth objects. And we're going to look at all the other exciting places to go in the solar system. So The compelling reasons for doing so are, we like to characterize them as like six primary themes. It's about human civilization, because it's our innate desire, much like going from the New World or exploring the unknown, is very much even about species preservation in a way. Secondly, it's going back to the moon, with it being just 3 to 3.5 days away, it's the closest celestial body to the Earth from which to try out and prepare for our further exploration in terms of our systems, in terms of our procedures and our technologies and our countermeasures for the very challenging environment of space. Certainly, there's huge economic potential benefit in terms of economic expansion and bringing the moon into Earth's economic sphere, whether it be in support of commercial communications and navigation or logistics for resupply, much like a shipping company back and forth, as well as the potential energy and manufacturing aspects. So those are three of the themes, and there's six total. The other three would be scientific exploration. And in a sense, the moon holds many exciting opportunities in looking at not only our record of impacts by meteorites, but also looking at comet impacts and looking at the mineralogy of the moon. Also, it's one of the few places that on the backside of the moon, as it's shielded or silent from the Earth's radio frequency noise, and so there's a lot of exciting opportunities there. And we also believe it's going to have radical impacts on our understanding of not only Earth science but planetary science and our ability to go beyond. The last two are about global partnerships and working together in a truly collaborative international environment, leveraging the great lessons learned from the International Space Station and building upon that towards peaceful endeavors that benefit all of humanity. That's really what it's about. And finally, last but not least, maybe one of the most important ones, it's about public engagement. It's about getting people to believe that, as we learned 40 years ago by going to the moon, that nothing's impossible if you dedicate the requisite resources and work and commit as a nation, as a human race to that goal. But it's also about educating the next generation, you know, for our innovation or our technology societies and our industrialized societies. It's absolutely essential to continually harness and push the bounds. And so going to the moon excites and builds generations of folks looking at science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, and all the other fields that it takes to succeed in the global marketplace. And so In a net, those are the compelling reasons of why we are going and why we need to do so now. It's been 40 years. It's time to go back, but we're going back to stay, and it's not just the moon. It's moon as a stepping stone to much broader and ambitious goals.
Dr. John Olson from NASA, and there's more from him and full coverage of the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landings at guardian.co.uk/space. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Roxanne Escobales and Phil Maynard. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.